The hour of 8:30 having arrived, I'll call to order state and local government operations reforms, technology, and elections. The Hansen bill, House File 297, is no longer on the agenda. Representative Simon, House File 8.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for your time here. First, I'd like to make the motion. Mr. Chair, my motion would be that House File 8 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommendation, if that's in order, that it be referred then to the Division on State Government Finance.
All right. Do your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you'd like me to put on the amendments first or discuss the bill first.
Well, if the amendments go on, is that the bill that you wish to have before us, or are you going to do the bill and then the amendments are problematic?
No, the amendments are not problematic.
If they're not problematic, then let's take one amendment at a time and tell us which one you want first.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
All right. You've moved it, so why don't you explain it first?
Well, if I could, Mr. Chair, I think it would make more sense, at least from my vantage point, to put the amendments on and then describe the bill as a whole.
All right. Then all those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also next like to move the A4 amendment.
All right. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So your bill is amended.
Thank you. And members, the reason for the two amendments instead of just putting it all in one was the last one was the result of a 11th hour negotiation, so it wasn't produced in time to make it into the A3 amendment. That's the only reason for the two. Members, thanks a lot for your time. This is House File 8, which is the False Claims Act for Minnesota. I think we can all agree that defrauding the taxpayers is always a bad thing, but it's even worse during times like these. And this year with House File 8, I think we can do something about that, and we can get at contractors with the state who knowingly defraud our state government. And at the same time, we can earn Minnesota a generous financial reward from the federal government just for doing it. That is to say, just for passing this law, we get an automatic reward, even if the law is never used, even if it sits on a shelf forever and no one uses it, we get a financial reward. And I want to stress one thing before I go on, Mr. Chair and members, and that is the word knowingly. Knowingly is key here because that's the standard. This is not a bill aimed at those who accidentally or negligently or mistakenly falsely bill the government or underpay or overbill or whatever. This is aimed only at conduct which is knowing. And the standard set forth in the bill, same knowingly standard in all 50 states, is a very high bar. So I really want to emphasize that. This isn't getting at those who make a mistake. We all make mistakes. That's not what this is about. So this is the third hearing, members, for this bill. And it's traveling quickly also in the Senate. There are 35 authors, the maximum on this bill. I've had now 10 meetings, and that's not counting Senator Latz in the Senate. I've had 10 meetings with the various stakeholders, and I've listened to all of their concerns, and I'll continue to do that. I'll have 10 more. I'll have 40 more if I need to. And my door is always open to them, and I think that they know that. For example, the amendments that have already been added to the bill, both today and in previous committee hearings, incorporate, by my count, 11 of the 13 things that many of the stakeholders wanted. We gave on 11 of those things, conceded on 11, including a real big one, which I'll talk about in a minute. I've been talking with the governor's office and with various state departments. Just yesterday, I learned that the Department of Human Services is neutral on the bill. Right now, as far as we know, the governor's office is neutral on the bill. And there are some other departments, which I'm not supposed to name, which are reviewing it as well right now. So let me just tell you what this thing is. The original False Claims Act was enacted during the Civil War. It was known as Lincoln's Law. And it started out as a way for the government to pursue crooked contractors who sold bad mules and bad food to the Union Army. And a century later, under the Reagan administration, Congress and President Reagan improved the law by adding financial incentives for workers who report knowing fraud by their employers against the taxpayer. So now what happens since 1986 is that whistleblowers of this kind can bring claims directly on behalf of the government. So they can stand in the shoes of the government. And then law enforcement authorities on the federal level and in the states that have this law then have a certain period of time in which they can decide whether or not they want to intervene. They don't have to, but they can. Either way, the employees who uncover the knowing misconduct, and I want to stress that word knowing misconduct, are entitled to a percentage of the ultimate judgment or settlement. So That person has a stake in the claim. It's a way to incentivize whistleblowers. And the wrongdoer is liable for up to 3 times the government's actual damages. And so as a result, the federal government has recovered $22 billion in fraud that belongs to the taxpayers since 1986. $22 billion. But the federal law only applies to contractors who knowingly cheat the federal government. The states are on their own. The states have to fend for themselves. So 22 states now have enacted their own versions of the False Claims Act to confront contractors again who knowingly defraud the system. I have to point out here that this really should be a bipartisan measure. As I've mentioned before, Ronald Reagan signed the sort of landmark updates to the law in 1986. Governor George W. Bush signed into law Texas's version of the False Claims Act. In Congress, the chief patron of the False Claims Act for the last 20-odd years has not been a Democrat. It's been a Republican, Charles Grassley of Iowa, and a close second for the time that he was in the Senate with Senator John Ashcroft, later Attorney General, the Republican from Missouri. So this is not a partisan matter. It shouldn't be a partisan bill. So this gets at contractors who double bill, who underpay, who charge for undelivered goods or services, who create phantom employees with doctored timesheets. And so the results have been there. In your handouts, and I won't belabor the point, are some examples. And they're just that, examples. It's not an exhaustive list of various state settlements, some large, some medium-sized, but I think everyone counts. And, for example, here are some that are not on that list that you have before you. Illinois recently, in the last couple of years, recovered $40 million from an entity that had cheated the state, again, knowingly, not accidentally, knowingly, by accepting government payments for patients that it had not enrolled. They were dummy patients, they were phantom patients, and it was no accident or mistake. It was knowing fraud. The state of Massachusetts, you might have heard about the Big Gig project in Massachusetts, one of the greatest public work projects in the history of the United States. There was recently a settlement against one of the contractors there for, again, knowingly defrauding the state. So because of the successes of these laws at the state level, Congress decided to get in the act with the help of Senator Grassley just a couple years ago in 2006. And here's what Congress did under Senator Grassley's leadership. Congress said, look, states, these have been very successful in rooting out fraud. And the reason we care in Congress, they said, is because often the fraud is in the Medicaid program, which, of course, as you know, in Minnesota at least, is a 50-50 split. So the states have the feds have a stake in helping us to root out fraud, at least in the Medicaid program. So here's what the feds did. The feds said in 2006, they said, states, if you pass a False Claims Act and it meets 4 criteria, which I'm happy to describe, some of them are somewhat dry and boring, but 4 criteria, if you meet those 4 criteria, we will give you a 10% boost on your Medicaid fraud recoveries. And the way it works right now is this. Since it's a 50-50 split, MA or Medicaid in Minnesota, let's say somebody rooted out or found $10 million in fraud out there in Minnesota that pertains to the Medicaid program. That $5 million of that now has to go to the federal government. So we get to keep 5 and the feds get 5. If we pass this law and we get a Medicaid fraud recovery for $10 million, our share goes up to 60-40. We now get $6 million and we only have to send $4 million to Washington. That's just by passing this law. Even if no one ever uses it, if it sits on the shelf forever and not a single litigant comes forward, not a single whistleblower, we get a bonus automatically. But we have to meet those 10 criteria. And in the years since 2006, in the last couple of years, the federal government has given thumbs up to some False Claims Act for the 10% bump or bonus and thumbs down to others because they didn't meet the 4 criteria. So we're somewhat hemmed in if we want that 10% bonus. And so that's what the Minnesota False Claims Act would do. Just like the federal law, it provides financial incentives to whistleblowers whose employers knowingly, and that's the key word, knowingly defraud our state government. And so what would happen, again, just like the law in all 22 states, and just like the federal government, is the Attorney General's office would have 60 days to decide whether it wanted to intervene in the case or not. And I have to stress something else here that's very important, another key word. We intentionally crafted this statute to say that the Attorney General's office may investigate these claims and decide to intervene, not shall. And we did that because we wanted to give them maximum flexibility and also because in budgetary times like this, we didn't want to saddle a state agency with a mandate. So this is not a mandate on any agency in the state, including the Attorney General's office. If the AG's office in this state wanted not to be in the False Claims Act business, it wouldn't have to be. It wouldn't have to review a single one of these cases. And the Department of Human Services agrees. I just talked with them yesterday, and they say they see minimal, if no, impact of the Department of Human Services on these Medicaid claims. So this is not a mandate on any state agency to do anything whatsoever. But it does mean that once a particular plaintiff comes forward, they have to park their complaint basically for 60 days, give the government the chance if it wants to intervene. Again, just like the Fed, just like the 22 states. And then if they don't, if they take a pass, which is what happens in the vast, vast majority of cases, then the private plaintiff can go forward and try to seek to recoup these monies on behalf of all of our constituents, the taxpayers. So I want to emphasize again that this only applies to those who knowingly defraud. No contractor will ever be liable for accidental or inadvertent wrongdoing. And the other thing is, the only allowable claims are those where the whistleblower is the, quote, original source of the information about the fraud. I don't want anyone here getting the idea, and this has been litigated all up and down the courts in all the states, where the fact is, this is not about someone in an office setting who hears something through hearsay at the office cooler and decides they're going to suddenly sue for millions of dollars. The person, the plaintiff, who steps in the shoes of the government has to be the original and independent source. The original and independent source, which means it can't be water cooler talk. It can't be hearsay heard at the holiday party. It's got to be someone who's, you know, presumably deep enough within the operations of whatever entity we're talking about that they actually have independent knowledge of what they at least allege is going on. So this isn't just a scheme for people who hear things around the office, and I think that's an important point. Now, one of the things that I anticipate you might hear is, well, look, we've already got laws on the books. Why do we need yet another law on the books, still more trees, when we already have an action for common law fraud, and we already have tools in the toolbox that may enable us to get at some of these instances of misconduct? Well, the problem with that argument is this. First of all, the current laws in place don't go far enough. Some of them only address Medicaid fraud, only. They don't apply to a highway contractor. They don't apply to anyone else who does business with the state. Some of them only apply to successful fraud, those who actually defraud the state as by actually stealing money from the state instead of those who just merely submit a false claim. And then, finally, none of those allow a private whistleblower to stand in the shoes of the government. And I should add one more. None of them give us the 10% boost, the 10% bump from the federal government. And I need to emphasize, the real advantage here of this money on the table that we shouldn't leave on the table is if we pass this law and we meet their four criteria, we get the bonus no matter what. If this law is never used and collects dust for decades and centuries, we get that bonus. And I think that's an important point. 80% of False Claims Act cases are initiated by whistleblowers. And I want to just point out something that's been in the news recently, which at least to me seems like a compelling point about why whistleblowers are important. And you're going to hear from an actual one in a moment. But take the Petters case that we've all read about in the newspaper, the Tom Petters case. Now, again, that wasn't a False Claims Act case. That wasn't a case of fraud against the government, or at least as far as we know, at least as far as I know. But I think the analogy is a pretty good one, which is, if you remember the news accounts of how that came out, this woman, Deanna Coleman was her name, 42 years old. She'd been the right-hand person to Tom Petters for years. In sort of a pang of conscience, literally walked off the street into the FBI office and spilled the beans. And they have since very candidly and on the record acknowledged they had no clue of any of this. They weren't onto them. There was no surveillance involved. They had received no tips. Absolutely off the street. They have no inkling whatsoever. And I think that's an example, at least, of what can happen and the importance of having whistleblowers out there and incentivizing them and making sure that they come forward. So what I'd like to do, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, is hand it over to a real-life whistleblower in a False Claims Act case, someone here from the Twin Cities area, Neil Thompson. You may have seen him in the national media at the end of last year. He worked for a company that recently settled, I think it was over $9 million for the federal government, and it arose because of Mr. Neil Thompson's whistleblowing activity. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to hand it over to him.
Representative Simon, before we do that, I want to remind the members of the committee that House File 297, Representative Hansen, has been removed from the agenda, and that your motion is to send this to finance. So, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Neil Thompson, and I want to give this committee my perspective on the Minnesota False Claims Act and my perspective as a whistleblower. I am a whistleblower, and I spent 3.5 years of my life helping the state of Minnesota and the federal government recover taxpayers' money. I'm the individual that you may have seen on CNN, in the Star and Tribune, along with a friend of mine and colleague, Dan Burance, we turned in Walgreens Corporation for Medicaid fraud. I've been a pharmacist for 31 years and first working in my father's store, later owning my own pharmacy, and then later in my career I worked for some of the larger chains in Minnesota. I can confidently tell the committee that even though you've seen a lot of large awards and a lot of large, you'll hear about more today, you'll never have seen any of those awards if not for whistleblowers. Fraud by its very nature, it's hidden, it's perpetrated by very smart people, computer programmers, executive level people, and it's covered up by these same people. Even when I told my supervisors, and I told five different supervisors about this fraud as it was going on, they just said, well, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, we handle that down in the headquarters, and they really tried to just push me aside. It takes people working on the inside of companies, watching and overseeing and recognizing these types of frauds. The fraud that we exposed was very complex. It was a computer-based billing program that Walgreens, even though they employed 10,000, you know, highly educated pharmacists, none of them were able to recognize it until my friend and I actually analyzed some claims and checked them out with the Department of Human Services to really find out that this fraud was going on. The very basis of our system of laws is voluntary compliance. And if citizens don't step up and identify problems and comply with laws, the state of Minnesota doesn't have enough money in its treasuries to investigate all of the frauds and all of the crimes that are going on. So you need voluntary compliance. And one of those things is to help people like myself, whistleblowers, and to help whistleblowers be protected under the law. I think one of the why I say protected is that you have to understand that being a whistleblower is a career-ending event. Now, I've done a lot of things in my life. I've gone to pharmacy school. I have four wonderful children, and I went to the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy. I went to law school. I own my own pharmacy. I worked in a lot of different pharmacy-related professions. I had the right to get held up at gunpoint 8 times while I owned my own pharmacy. But I can tell you, nothing will be as stressful in your life as walking into your employer for 3.5 years knowing full well that you've sued your employer, that you've caused the FBI to appear at 12 of your supervisors' homes at 9 o'clock on a Sunday night, knowing that you probably have caused them to turn over millions and millions of dollars in fraudulent claims, knowing full well that you'll probably get fired or be asked to leave, and that you'll probably never, ever work in that profession again. I love being a pharmacist. My father was a pharmacist. I'm a pharmacist. My uncle was a pharmacist, and I love the profession. But since leaving Walgreens, I've applied for 5 different positions in pharmacy, and they don't even call me back. And this is in a climate where pharmacists are in huge demand. I mean, the students coming out of the College of Pharmacy right now have 5-6 job offers with signing bonuses, and Neil Thompson can't even get a call back from an employer because I turned in somebody as a whistleblower, causing them to turn over money. So the protections for whistleblowers have to be there. Otherwise, you're never, ever going to have people bringing these cases forward. You're never going to get the chance to recover the money that the state is losing in these cases. This law does a lot of things to eradicate fraud. It shows that the state of Minnesota is serious about recovering money. It increases the share that the state could recover in state-federal settlements. And it provides a whole host of tools to help whistleblowers bring fraudsters to justice. The issues in this law are not about Minnesota's share versus federal share or costs to the state versus whistleblower reward. Minnesota's already incurring these costs. They're already being cheated. The real issue is about whether or not Minnesota will ever get the chance to recover any of this money. Without the protection and the incentives for whistleblowers to bring these cases forward, you will not have the cases brought to you. Thank you very much.
For some time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to hand it over now, if I could, to Patrick O'Connell, who, until late 2007, was the head of the Texas Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. He's now in private practice, and he knows a thing or two about these types of cases, and I thought it would be useful to have him here to discuss the Texas experience and also emphasize this issue about the cost. Obviously, after yesterday, well, even before yesterday, we're all sensitive to that, and he's going to emphasize to you that this is a net win for the state, not a net loss of any kind. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Patrick O'Connell. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Barron & Budd. Prior to my employment at Barron & Budd, I was the chief of the Civil Medicaid Fraud Division of the Texas Attorney General's Office for 9 years. And thank you very much for having me today. As you might notice from my accent, I'm from a little farther south of here than Minnesota, from Austin, Texas. But you'll be happy to know in probably the largest case that was brought by the state of Texas that's still ongoing, that's recovered well over $100 million from the state of Texas. Our expert witness is Dr. Steve Schondelmeyer from the University of Minnesota, so we try to do business across the country. What I'd like to tell you today is that this type of law is extremely effective and is an important law that the state of Minnesota should have, in my opinion. Recognizing that I'm no longer with the state, I want to make sure you understand that I'm not speaking for the Attorney General, but only for myself. In 1995, Texas passed its Medicaid Fraud Prevention Act. It was patterned after the Federal False Claims Act. And from 1995 to 1997, there's not a single case brought to the state under that act because there were no quitom provisions. There were no provisions for whistleblowers to bring the cases to the state. If the state happened to come across the fraud, it had the ability to file suit, but we did not have any cases come forward during that period. 1997, the act was amended to provide for the whistleblower provisions. As Representative Simon said, George Bush signed it into law, and in 1999, when I went to the Attorney General's office, I worked for John Cornyn, now United States Senator, the first Republican Attorney General in the history of the state of Texas. And Senator Cornyn asked me to start the Civil Medicaid Fraud Division in Texas. His view was, and I won't give you all the details because they're in my letter to the committee, but basically his view was this statute needed to be used and wanted to make an effort to see if Texas should be recovering or if there were funds there Texas should recover. When I got to the office, there were two cases on file, one of which was not a very good case, and we declined it. The other case was brought by a small pharmacy in Key West, Florida, alleging that many major drug manufacturers were lying to the state directly about the cost of the drugs that they were selling to the pharmacists and doctors in the state of Texas and elsewhere. We took that case under our statute, did civil investigative demands of those companies, spent about a year investigating it, determined that the whistleblowers was correct. We've since, in that one case alone, collected, I believe, $128 million. Now, the federal government got their share of that because it was a Medicaid program. But I can promise you that none of that money would have been collected at this stage without the State False Claims Act. In fact, I think if you look at Minnesota's records, you'll find that you haven't collected a dime from Shearing Plow, Bay Labs, Roxanne, Abbott Labs. I could go on. It's four or five other companies that we've collected from. In addition, we've also rooted out fraud in entities that were not national entities, that were only Texas-based entities. I'm pretty daggum proud of what my group did over that time. In the 9 years that I was chief, and you have in your materials, I believe, from my former office, an email that describes how much money's been collected in total. I think it's $360 million. The reason that the Deficit Reduction Act has the provision that states, if they have their own False Claims Act, will receive an extra 10% is based upon Texas's experience. I was asked to testify to Congress in front of Senator Grassley's committee, and we were the example that the federal government wanted to see more action out of the states because they realized how much more effective that action would be. So I want to emphasize that, number one, it's financially a good thing for the state in two ways. One, you're getting this extra 10%, but in addition, you're going to find out about fraud that you don't know about at this stage. And it's important that you do. There's a great deterrent effect to it as well, in my opinion, that's probably not decipherable at this stage. But in Texas, we have had great success with it. I'd be happy to answer any questions about it or specifics. One final thing that I want to point out is that, that my entire time there was spent under two Republican attorney generals who were tremendously supportive of this action. As Representative Simon said, this is a bipartisan thing, and it should be. And our legislature in Texas, in fact, went to the trouble after the Deficit Reduction Act was passed of deciding that we probably ought to spend some more money. And in the last legislative session, I was asked to go to our legislature and explain to them what it would take for the Texas Attorney General to do all the cases that were in our shop. And when I say that, remember that's if we decided to go forward and chase all these cases. We could have declined every one of them if we wanted to. And the legislature appropriated an extra $12.2 million. And the budget office determined that, in their estimation, it wasn't going to cost the state anything, because clearly the evidence was that we would collect far more than the $12.2 million. And the email that you have from my old office indicates that just since 2007, we've collected three times as much as what it's cost the state to pay for the extra lawyers and the extra staff and time. So. Again, anything I can tell you about the Texas experience, I'd be happy to give you more details.
Representative Simon, we've taken testimony about this being bipartisan, and you have 35 authors. We can see five of them. How many of the 35 are Republicans on the bill?
Mr. Chair, zero of them are Republicans, but there's a reason for that, if you want me to explain.
All right.
But the reason for that is that, as you may remember, Mr. Chair, you were there. I made an announcement in a DFL caucus meeting about the bill, and before I knew it, the jackets were done. So by the time I had the maximum spots before I even was able to even approach any Republicans. So I suppose we could do a clone bill, but that's the reason. I don't think it reflects.
Representative Simon, my next question should be how many are attorneys, but I won't go there. Representative Gutwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Connell, you answered one of my questions, that you've collected three times more than you've actually spent adjudicating or investigating these cases. Is that correct?
Well, it's actually a lot more than that.
Excuse me, Mr. O'Connell. Let's go through the chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I apologize, Mr. Chair. And members, the three times figure is only for collections since the biennial budget was passed in 2007. The actual figure since 1999, and again, I don't have them exactly, but the state of Texas has collected over $360 million. Some of that money was paid to whistleblowers. Some of it was paid to the federal government, but Texas itself has collected in far in excess of $100 million, and that cost is I would say, less than $10 million.
Representative Gutwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Connell, of the cases, okay, a whistleblower brings the case forward, and of the number of those cases, what percentage actually get to the finish line?
Mr. O'Connell.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. In the federal system, which has had much more experience in the Texas system, I would say that it's probably finish line less than 10%. First of all, you have a certain amount of cases that are declined. The whistleblower may go forward without the government, but as a general rule, the whistleblower would prefer that the government was there with them, working the case together. Obviously, having the power of the government behind you is better than not having the power of the government behind you. The other problem is that these cases can take a long time. For example, in the in the whistleblower case I told you about involving drug pricing, that whistleblower brought the case to us in 1999. It took us about a year to investigate. We sued three drug manufacturers because I only had two lawyers working for me at the time. Those three drug manufacturers defended the case mightily. By the time I finished, I had 10 lawyers working for me. Begged, borrowed, and stole folks from different divisions. And the reason for that was that the more manufacturers we sued, the more lawyers we saw on the other side. So literally, in that one case, that case is still going on. So we've settled with 8 or 9 manufacturers, but there's still 20 more. If I had had the lawyers to do the case immediately, we wouldn't have been taking that long. But unfortunately, we just didn't have the staff to do it. So part of the problem is, how long does it take to run the case forward? So we've got a lot of ongoing cases in the state of Texas that haven't been finished yet.
Mr. Chair, just one quick follow-up. But Mr. O'Connell, did you see an increase in Texas in frivolous lawsuits as a result of this? I mean, fishing expeditions.
My experience is that I saw almost no frivolous lawsuits. From the time I started, when there were 2 cases on file, to the time I finished, there were 175 cases on file. In each of those cases, the allegation of the whistleblower, I can't remember a single one that there was not truth to the allegation. It turns out it may not have cost the state very much money. It may have been a lie, but there wasn't much damage to the state, so we may not have proceeded forward. It may have turned out that the lie was not a violation of law, even though it was a lie. So there are often instances where you don't go forward in the case, even though technically the whistleblower was correct about their allegation. So my experience is you don't find much. And part of the reason that you don't find much frivolous filing is most filings, when they're brought by lawyers, and I'm one of those lawyers who does that now. I represent states directly as well as cities across the country in various matters, but also with my firm also represents whistleblowers. A whistleblower, like you've heard from before, he's not paying me by the hour. He doesn't have the money to pay me by the hour. So we are working on a contingent fee. I have no business bringing forward a case. I don't think it's really good and legitimate on a contingent fee. I'm not going to. So you're not going to see very many frivolous lawsuits, if any, in my view.
President Fenn. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just occurred to me that I hadn't explained the amendments yet and what we did. But before I do that, I want to address one issue. And it stems from something you said, Mr. Chair, and I'm sure you didn't mean to impugn my motives or integrity. But I understand that you have a letter in the packet from former Attorney General Mike Hatch. Is that true? I had seen the letter before. I don't know who put it there. I certainly didn't, where he weighed in on this. Now, let's just get it all out there. It's no secret he's not a big fan of mine. I'm off the Christmas card list. But he wrote this letter, and he's entitled to his opinion. But there's one thing in there, Mr. Chair, that he said, and I think, and I hope that you didn't inadvertently stoke that fire, Mr. Chair. He took a swipe at me and my integrity in there, and he implied, if not outright said, that I am carrying this bill to feather my own nest. And I want the record to be perfectly crystal clear, Mr. Chair, that I am not feathering my nest. My law firm doesn't do False Claims Act cases. I don't anticipate I would ever do a False Claims Act case. And if anyone thinks that I am carrying this bill, whether you agree it or not, with it or not, because I am a lawyer, or because my law firm will somehow benefit, then we can have that discussion elsewhere. But I appreciate it if people would tell that to my face rather than making innuendo.
President Fenn, the letter was inserted at the request of one of the groups that will testify today. I do not insert testimony into the file for or against the bill. My process here is to facilitate and make an occasional observation. And to the extent that I've done that today, it was not to impugn the character of anyone, but simply to observe and facilitate. So with that, let's go to Carrie Thurlow, I believe.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to describe the amendments that we put
in? All right, Representative Simon, okay. Describe the amendments.
The A3 amendment, members, there are 4 changes. And again, we put on, as I said, in the prior committee, we put on 10 of the 13 suggested amendments by some of the stakeholders you're going to hear from today. And my door is always open to them. I'll meet 10 or 20 or 30 more times with them to see if we can reach ultimate common ground. What we did is, The first thing, on line 1.3 through 1.5, we put in some comfort language to make sure that we didn't think it was is probably necessary, but we made clear to everyone that no one is liable for mere inadvertence or mistake. The second change we made on lines 1.7 and 1.8 was to clarify, and this is a large portion of Mr. Hatch's letter is aimed at this provision, and we took that out. And his argument was that, the state's going to incur defense costs because the AG's office is the lawyer for various units of government. Well, we never meant, as none of the other states mean, to make state and local units of government liable under this. So we just took that out, and that's consistent. And you'll see that a good third to half of the Hatch letter is aimed at that provision. On lines 1.10 through 1.12, it basically clarifies the federal standard that if the Attorney General decides not to intervene in the case and then changes its mind, so that it decides not to intervene and then a year or two or 3 years later decides to intervene, just like on the federal level, then it retakes authority and control of the litigation away from the private plaintiff. And then finally, on lines 1.14 through 1.17, this was put in at the request of the Department of Human Services. They drafted this language, and this has to do with TANF money. That's the impetus for this, which is that apparently this is a federal statute, and they wanted clarification that they might be bound by that federal statute as to recoveries for TANF fraud. So that's that amendment. As for the A4 amendment, and this is a big one, members, this was a big give. This was a big concession. This is getting rid of retroactivity. Now, if I had my druthers, I would want retroactivity in the bill, because I think that if there's fraud going on today, March 4, 2009, we ought to get at it. If our constituents and our taxpayers are being cheated by people, again, who knowingly do this, and that's the standard, knowingly, then we ought to be able to get at it. But many of the groups you're going to hear from don't like that provision, and it is true that the majority of the states and the federal government don't have retroactivity. So last night, we agreed to take retroactivity out of the bill. And so now, this bill will only apply to conduct after the effective date, which I think is August 1st, 2009. So any conduct today going on right now will not be actionable under this bill. It's a fresh start. It's a clean slate. Only any alleged misconduct that occurs after the effective date of this bill. That was a very big give. And we did that in the interest of seeking, getting us a little closer to harmony here. I don't think we'll get total harmony, but we're getting real close. All right. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right. Let's get Kerry Thurlow, please. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record. And if you could address the bill as it is now amended, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kerry Thurlow. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for Aging Services of Minnesota, but I'm also here appearing on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative, which is a collaboration between the association for which I work and Care Providers of Minnesota. I will try to keep my comments brief into the bill as amended, and also want to say at the outset, at first I want to thank Representative Simon for his willingness to meet with us to express our concerns about the bill and to continue to work on this bill. Having said that, we still do have concerns with the bill as amended, and I'll briefly discuss that. I also want to make clear at the outset that nobody likes fraud, and of course, intentional fraud in the state of Minnesota should be prosecuted and should be deterred as much as possible. But the folks that I represent are the long-term care providers in the state of Minnesota, nursing homes, assisted living, housing with services, the folks that care for seniors. They neither have large legal funds, nor do they have tremendously large staff, but they deal with tremendously complex issues when they have to do billing as well as charting. And this particular bill has an impact on them that we still have concerns. My concerns primarily rest with lines 2.29 to 2.31 of the bill. This particular clause of the bill relates to inadvertent mistakes in the bill, and I know that Representative Simon has made some amendment language later in the bill that addresses some of our concerns, but we still have concerns with this particular provision of the bill. It would provide that a provider would be liable for inadvertent mistakes If after discovering the falsity of the claim, they knowingly fail to disclose the falsity of the claim within a reasonable time. Now, I know that sounds reasonable on the face, that as long as they knowingly sort of cover it up, that it still causes problems. The issue that we have is sort of this gray area. First of all, who would knowingly fail to disclose it, and what is a reasonable time? That gray area causes a lot of problems for us. Say you're the director of nursing in a facility and realize that there's been a charting error that has resulted in some inadvertent mistakes in billing Medicaid. The director of nursing realizes that it's a problem. They fix the problem, but for whatever reason, he or she does not go to the administrator or the operator to disclose the mistake. Maybe because he or she doesn't want to lose their job or what have you. That particular issue could create imputed knowledge on the part of our providers and leaves us on the hook there. What we would like to see is not necessarily removing this language, but adding language that gives us the right to cure in those situations. When we discover that there's been a cover-up, when we discover that somebody has not fully disclosed that they've made a mistake, that they give healthcare providers every opportunity to fix that, to disclose to the state, to pay back those funds when a mistake has been made, to perhaps take action with regard to staff and make any sort of action that would cure the situation before we are on the hook for inadvertent mistakes. We've mentioned these concerns to Representative Simon. We'll continue to work to propose develop some language that would fit and perhaps give us that right to cure. If that issue was addressed, I think that we would be more comfortable with the bill. But without that language, we do have concerns. And again, it's not that we are opposed to preventing fraud, and it's not that we are opposed to fixing mistakes. But it's these gray areas that long-term care facilities are even if we get to the point where it's decided that it is an inadvertent mistake, that we'll still have to defend against. And those are the issues that we are concerned with. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but in the interest of time, I'll keep my testimony brief, Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer, and if we can keep the questions to the witnesses for the time being in reference to what they're talking about in the bill, and then once the witnesses are done, we can do the bill in general. So, Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ma'am, you said two things as I was listening to you. One, your exact words were, when we discover there has been a cover-up, and two, you talked several times about when we find out there has been a mistake or an inadvertent mistake. Those are two completely different things. If you could please explain or go a little bit more in detail and maybe even use examples of what you mean by when we discover a cover-up. How do you discover a cover-up without this type of law and that sort of thing? I'd appreciate it. Mistakes I'm not so worried about because I think we all agree with that, but I think what Representative Simon Phil does is it goes to fraud, and there's no such thing as inadvertent fraud. So I'd like to know what you mean by when we discover there's been a cover-up. How do you do that? What do you do?
Ms. Phil.
Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, thank you. And that was probably a poor choice of words on my part, so let me try to clarify, and thank you for the opportunity. I think where we're concerned is where an employee, where there may have been a discovery that perhaps there's been an inadvertent mistake. Perhaps billing codes have changed, and the wrong billing code has been entered over a period of time. And so it's an inadvertent mistake. They realize it's an inadvertent mistake. They fix the problem. But for whatever reason, perhaps that employee knows, but doesn't necessarily, I think the issue here is in that situation when the employee knows and the employer finds out, the provider finds out, we need time to fix it. We need time to be able to go to the state, say, you know, we'll repay the funds that have been inadvertently paid due to the mistake, that we will do additional corrective action, training the employee so it doesn't happen again. If all of those steps, those cure steps, are taken, we would argue that those are not the types of mistakes that should be held liable under this provision. What we are seeking here is where there are mistakes, that we are given time to fix the problem. And so I don't know if that example provides greater clarity. Another example is the federal government, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare, are currently going through a system where they are changing our coding, the MDS coding process for nursing homes. It's extremely complex. There probably will be mistakes that are made. And again, we are seeking language that would, in the case of those mistakes, if an employee does make a mistake, that again, that the state is notified, that the funds are paid back, that corrective action is taken either in training or otherwise, that would again prevent the mistake from happening again. Those are the types of situations that we're hoping to address with some additional language.
Thank you. Thanks for that, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, I thought your bill was just dealing with fraud, not with inadvertent mistakes.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Member. It is, and I think your initial insight was right, and that's why we amended even this provision in the previous committee. Members would look at lines 2.29 to 2.31. We added in the word knowingly failed to disclose. We also got rid of the set time period. It originally said if they knowingly failed to disclose within 60 days, and we thought that was unduly burdensome. We just said a reasonable time. It might be more than 60 days. You know, that depends on the circumstance. But I think the key word there is knowingly. If what we just heard from Ms. Thurlow is correct, and I have every reason to believe it is, that in Minnesota there's no problem here. But if they do all the steps that she just described to you, which I think are absolutely responsible and the right thing to do and I'm sure are happening now, then that wouldn't be captured under here because that's not a knowing failure to disclose. This is the finder's keepers provision, so-called. And we want to sort of make sure we don't have a finder's keeper situation. The other analogy that's been used in other states is shoplifting. You don't get to steal the iPods from Best Buy, and then when a bus keeps driving out of the parking lot, say, hey, you caught me, here you go, let's just call this over and I get to go away. We don't do that. Once you do it, if you knowingly do it, now if you accidentally walk out of Best Buy and you just had no idea, your kid slipped it into your bag or something like that, that's a different story. But this is for those who knowingly failed to disclose after they discovered that someone in the company, someone in the chain did something they shouldn't have done. The company knows about it, discovers it, and then says, you know what, they don't need to know. No one's going to find out. That's what this is. So I guess I stand by the characterization that this is only for knowing fraud, even as to this particular provision.
Ms. Thurlow, you want to respond?
And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I appreciate Representative Simon's willingness to work with us. I think there have been some changes to the provision. But again, where we are concerned is still there's a gray area here. And we want to make crystal clear that if there's evidence that the employer has taken steps after finding out about the problem, has taken steps to repay, has taken steps to retrain, and all of those steps are taken, we would like clarity that those steps, the right to cure, then would preclude a claim under this. Our concern is that there's still a gray area where there's at least a fact pattern that could be litigated that wasn't met within a reasonable time, that perhaps, you know, knowledge was imputed on the employer. And that's what we're really trying to clarify here. We want to clarify as much gray area as possible by showing that providers did the right thing and that they should not then have to defend against claims in those cases.
Representative Gallo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Thurlow, is there a potential here that nursing homes would end up having to pay more for liability insurance as a result of this? I mean, I know they're already strapped for finances as it is. If this avenue or venue is opened up with the gray area that you've described, is there a potential that you're going to end up having to pay more for insurance in this area?
Ms. Thurlow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, the possibility exists. We've asked the question, and we're still trying to gather information on that. But to the extent that there are potential claims that they may have to be litigated, I think that possibility exists, although we're still trying to gather information.
President Emmer.
Mr. Chair, perhaps there's a witness that will come down and testify, but it's my understanding you can't buy insurance to protect it from criminal acts like fraud. But maybe somebody could enlighten us further if that's incorrect, because I think there's a lot of folks who would be buying that insurance.
Any further questions? Ms. Thurlow. All right, seeing Phil Griffin is next on the agenda. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record, and if you could address yourself to the bill as now amended.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm here representing the eight companies who make up the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, with the adoption of the A4 amendment, the Minnesota Council of Health Plans has been working with Representative Simon. I contacted staff yesterday afternoon when we still had objections to the bill. With the adoption of that amendment, we no longer have objections to the bill. Are there questions, Mr. Chairman, members? I'd be happy to take them.
Any questions? No? All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Next on the agenda, Dave Kleinlock. Is he here? There he is. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is David Feinwatch. I'm General Counsel for the Minnesota Hospital Association. This concept, the False Claims Act, is a very old concept. It's been around since the Civil War. And so, you know, what we're dealing with here are variations and iterations. The False Claims Act was originally enacted, you know, to go after people who were selling the Union Army dead horses. I represent hospitals. We don't do that. Anybody who's eaten a hospital cafeteria knows what we do with our dead horses. Now I've got the dietitian back. All right. We are none too fond of this concept, and let me tell you why. But before I do that, the letters in your packet, in the interest of full and fair disclosure, I'm the one who has to have those letters put there. And Representative Simon said that, you know, he's off the hatches Christmas card list. I represent hospitals. We were never on that list. In fact, the only thing we ever got from Mr. Hatch were subpoenas and civil investigative demands. But having said that, I wanted the letter considered because I think it presents a perspective and at least a framework for viewing this, which I hope that people will find useful in evaluating the validity of the concept. And so let me begin with this. And I've told this story before. Let me give you an example of what we're talking about. And I think Representative Emmer has asked some excellent questions which really need to be addressed. I want to take a shot. This is something I've actually been involved with, okay? We've had one of our hospitals, they called me up and they go, we got a problem here. We had a person who works here and they're an occupational therapy assistant. Now, in Minnesota, those folks are licensed. They're great folks and they're very important. They help people recover from strokes and they're licensed. And this person worked part-time over a nine-year period. She put in about 1,000 hours, so less than 6 months of work over a nine-year period part-time. She was qualified to hold a license. She passed the test. She never sent in the money for the license. She didn't have a license. Now, every case she was involved with is technically, and I suppose in reality, a fraudulent case. And now, upon the hospital coming to me with this set of circumstances and said, what do we do? I said, well, here's what you need to do. Number one, you got to notify the government right away. You got to tell them this is what happened. And ask them how they want to handle it. You get disallowed for the whole thing, even though this person might have been, you know, $500 in a $10,000 case, or do you parse out the $500, or whatever you do. Second thing, you immediately have to figure out, how the heck can this happen? Well, they did that. And how the heck this could happen was that every January, they review all their people to make sure everybody's got a license, and this person managed to schedule himself so that every January, she wasn't working. There was a defect in their system. They figured it out. They closed it up. Of course, the person who did this was let go because, you know, it's wrong. So here's an example of fraud. Now, going to a couple of issues that have been raised, the notion of cover-up and discovery. The person in the record department who first came across this thought it was odd but didn't realize the significance of this set of circumstances. It took the administrator and attorneys to recognize the significance of this circumstance, and there's a time gap there. And within that time gap, there is the potential of liability. Now, certainly our position is we are against fraud, real and perceived. We want it corrected. We want people to do the right things. We're all for that. Everybody's for that. We don't want to get trapped in that gap. Secondly, Representative Emmer asked a question about insurance. No insurance covers fraud. But what insurance does do is, when you're accused of something and you deny it, which most people do because most of the time it's not true, insurance does pay for the cost of defense. And the cost of that defense and the number of times those claims occur will increase, and insurance premiums will increase, and costs will increase. Now, having said that, I also want to say something else, because this is important, and it doesn't get to anybody's integrity, but it has to do with who's for it and who's against it. Now, okay, I represent the hospital. We don't like this. We don't want new forums. We don't want new causes of action. We don't want judges who heretofore haven't considered this, and we don't want to start over again. I was around in the early 90s when the lab unbundling cases were undertaken by the federal government. And I remember when a representative from the U.S. Attorney's Office, you know, came to us as hospitals when we were, you know, defending ourselves. And said, well, if all these hospitals act in concert and create a joint defense to save money, we will say that that's obstruction of justice. And I remember my response to this gentleman. It was very direct, and it was two words. One of them was you. I said, well, thank you for bringing that to my attention, but we defended that cause of action, and let me tell you what the result was. This is a long time ago. This is the early 90s. We paid out $500,000, not a penny to the government. It all went to Fagerie and Benson. And I still have fond memories of that because every Christmas I still get a Harry and David basket from Fagerie and Benson, you know, which is nice. But we defend these things, and there are, from our perspective, claims that are bought that are frivolous. There's something else I want to say about this. When you look at, you know, who's for it, you know, lawyers are for it. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, there's some people who are conspicuously missing. This is the third or fourth hearing on this I've attended. There's nobody here from the Attorney General's office. There's never been anyone here from the Attorney General's office going, whoa, this is a great idea, let's do it, we've got to have it. In fact, my understanding is there's a fiscal note working its way through the system that says this is going to cost between $7 and $8 million for the biennium. And number two, there's nobody here from the state. You know, this is sort of like lawyers seeking litigation without plaintiffs. This gives us cause for concern. I have personally seen situations, I know Ms. Thurlow speaks for the nursing homes, but I've seen cases brought where a nursing home is cited because the hot water is too hot and somebody might get scalded, and somebody brings a case and says, well, that means that the care is defective because by definition you're out of compliance. Now, the Attorney General doesn't take cases like that. But if you pass this law, the Attorney General is going to have to wade through that, and that's going to cost money. There's a couple of hundred of these cases stacked up nationwide. They're going to have to wade through all of that. That's where the fiscal note comes from. The case I gave with the occupational therapy assistant, Attorney General is going to take that case, thankfully. We did the right thing. But I don't think anybody else should take that case either. And I don't think that the floodgate should be opened up to encourage that kind of thing. We have a False Claims Act. It works. The Attorney General has plenty of authority over not only hospitals, but nursing homes and other health care providers, and they are diligent, and believe me, I know, and they are aggressive in defending the public fisc, and we don't need this. We have protection for whistleblowers. Whistleblowers are protected under Minnesota law, and they should be protected, and we encourage people to do this. But in these times of hardship, I think we have to ask a real question about what the price tag is, what the hassle value is, and what we're doing. And those are the questions that I ask you to consider. I also put into the packet a letter from the Attorney General's office in the state of Washington that basically says, you know, it sounds good and it looks good, but it's not that good and it's expensive. And it's just going to create burden and expense for people. So I would respectfully ask you not to do this. Thank you.
Mr. Fanning, before we go to questions, I requested yesterday that the Attorney General's office be present today to testify. So I will ask, is there a representative from the Attorney General's office here today? I had staff make a direct call to a human being, and there is no one. And I will say just for the record, the chair is disappointed that the Attorney General's office is not here. We had a meeting with the Attorney General for a half hour, and I will say also with President Simon, two meetings, to the very points you brought up. And I would have hoped the Attorney General would have been here today or a representative from that office to confirm what you said. That is a disappointment. So, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Feinlich, I'm just following up on the letter from Mike Hatch. How did you come by a copy of that?
Mr. Feinlich.
I received it from a colleague in the hospital community who gave it to me. I only gave it to the chair yesterday. I got it a couple days ago from a friend of mine who gave it to me. The same friend gave me the letter from the Washington AG.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Feinlich, so you don't know ultimately. I mean, the letter was not copied, I don't think, to anybody in the hospital association. In fact, it looks like it's a personal letter from Mike Hatch to, I'm sorry, I can't remember how to, Wadalevich? looks like a personal letter to him. Do you have any knowledge of how this friend of yours in the hospital association might have come by a letter from Mr. Hatch to Mr. Wadalevich?
Mr. Fineway, it may have come through Mr. Hatch. It may have come through a variety of sources. I know that, and despite the fact that both my parents are Polish, I apologize, I can't say that name either. I know that he has been active in this for a number of years, going back to when Hatch was AG, and so I think that whatever discussions occurred are well known.
Mr. Chair, I'm also curious, Mr. Fineworks, about your knowledge of the fiscal note that's going through the system.
Yes, I made direct inquiry of the Attorney General's office, and I asked someone there, and I said, my impression is that this thing is going to cost some dough. Am I crazy? And I was told, no, there is a fiscal note, and I said, is it available? I don't think it's public yet, but I said, can you give me an idea of, roughly where it is, and I received a ballpark estimate.
And Mr. Final,
President Winkler, the ballpark estimate that he testified to, I can confirm to from the Attorney General in a meeting with my office with staff. So the number that he alluded to, I had wanted to have on the record from the AG today. There is no one from the Attorney General's office here, which may indicate there's a problem with that number.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Feinwachs, are you a registered lobbyist?
I am, Mr. Feinwachs.
Mr. Feinwachs, Mr. Chair, I am a little bit concerned that you would provide this letter from Mr. Hatch without being able to testify as to how it came to your hands, and in which it accuses members of the legislature of having a conflict of interest, which is a fairly serious ethical violation, which of course is completely untrue. And if you have any basic knowledge of conflict of interest rules and how they apply to the legislature, or just the general sense of ethics, you would know is not true. Now, there may be people who advocate for the bill from the Minnesota Association of Justice or the trial lawyers who have an interest in its passage. And those lawyers, of course, are allowed to come and advocate at the state legislature, as any other group, including the hospital association, is allowed to come and advocate at the legislature on behalf of a particular bill if they believe it serves their industry or interest. However, just because a member of the legislature is a lawyer and they deal with a bill that is legal in nature or could create a claim does not mean that they have a conflict of interest any more than a teacher who serves on an education committee might have a conflict of interest, or a union member or a business owner might have a conflict of interest, any of those issues. And so I guess, I asked for a copy of the Minnesota Government Relations Council Code of Ethics, and I think that your insertion of that letter with that accusation from a highly biased source, and when you cannot testify as to how you came to get the letter or how it got from Mr. Hatch's hands into your hands, is a violation of your ethics. And I don't believe that you should be engaged in that kind of conduct. I certainly don't think highlighting that particular passage is constructive to your cause, and I think you are ill-serving the people that you represent by doing so.
Mr. Fanlon. Mr. Chairman, Representative, I appreciate your perspective, and I would note for the record that I have never used the word conflict of interest. That's your term. I don't think there's any serious doubt as to the authenticity of the correspondence, and I think that the letter does not raise issue of conflict of interest in my mind, but rather raises conflict of who are the proponents and what is the commonality of their perspective in relation to evaluating the necessity for this proposal. That's why I thought it should be considered as an interesting perspective, if you will, and I don't think it is dispositive by any means of this issue, but it does raise a legitimate perspective. Lawyers want this. Lawyers are wonderful people. I'm a lawyer, which may disprove the first statement, but that's the perspective, and that's why it was offered, and I think all points of view should be considered in such a very important issue.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd just like to read out loud specifically the passage that you highlighted in the letter that you provided. It says, the current authors of the bill, which include Representative Simon and Senator Latt in the Senate, the current authors of the bill are both trial lawyers, as are you. Indeed, one of the lawyers is a member of a firm which made $500 million off the state in the tobacco trial, a firm that would profit perhaps profit more than any other from the passage of such a law. if that's not an accusation of a conflict of interest, it is in every possible way other than the use of the term. And to say that just because you don't use that phrase doesn't mean that it's not an accusation. For you to highlight and provide that in our packets is to make, in effect, the accusation of a conflict of interest. And I think that you should be very careful in doing that. I think members of the legislature often feel that an unfair attack on one member's integrity is an attack on the entire institution. And I personally think that you are not performing services properly as a registered lobbyist.
Representative Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd rather leave the conflict of interest discussion to another time. And
I would hope we would, too.
And I'd like to, if I could, if I may, respond to some of what's been said. Unless you'd rather.
Well, I've got a list of people, but go ahead, and we're going to migrate down this list, but go ahead, Representative Feinlein.
Mr. Chair, do you mean a list of other testifiers?
No, a list of members, and I don't know if their comments are directed to Mr. Feinlein. They might be, or to that, and they are, I see people nodding. So go ahead, Representative Feinlein, if you want to briefly respond, and then we'll go to the members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate Mr. Feinlein's perspective. We just disagree. There's a lot to cover here, so I'll try to be quick. First of all, I want everyone to know that there is already a federal False Claims Act in effect. There's already a federal False Claims Act in effect. So there's no, we're not creating any higher standards. All these evils that you've been warned of, they exist now, if they exist at all. Because right now, this same language exists in the federal statute. So they already have this over their shoulder. This just means that the state gets paid when the state is defrauded for the same conduct. Right now, the feds get money that we don't if there is a finding of fraud. That's all this is. They're already living under this. There will be no change. There's going to be no heightened standard of conduct. There's going to be no new employee training. They already live under the same regime of laws. The only difference with this law is we get our money for our constituents on the state level. That's what this law does. In terms of who's for it and who's against it, I'd hope that we wouldn't go down this road, and it's the classic tactic of someone with their back up against the wall. But we could talk about the big pharma industry. Their lobbyists are in the room. They're not testifying, and I'm sure for good reason, because when you see that list of the big payouts in other states of those where there are jury verdicts, juries of their peers, everyday citizens who have found that there is knowing fraud, half to two-thirds of those are pharmaceutical companies. They don't dare show their face here or testify, and they haven't yet, even though I know some of them are in the room. So we can get into that battle of who's for it and who's against it and who's bankrolling which efforts. I would gladly have that discussion, but I don't think there's time for it today. In terms of the Hatch letter and the Attorney General's office members, I have to say, let me tell you my impression of the AG's office and what's going on here. This initially started out in 2004. The False Claims Act was first introduced in this legislature in 2004 by Nora Flowick and I think Senator Leo Foley at that time. It was an AG's office initiative. Mike Hatch gave the bill to Nora Flowick and the senator. I think it was Foley in the Senate. They had a press conference. They did media on it. He was all for this. Same in 2005, same in 2006, then again under Lori Swanson in 2007, and in 2008, they were absolutely for this. And in the letter that preceded the Hatch letter, which I don't think is in your packet, the letter they just responding to, was basically a letter to the Attorney General Lori Swanson saying, what gives? Four times in the last year, said the letter writer, Mr. Watlovich, I met with you, and others in the community met with you, and you said not only were you for the bill, you wanted to do a press conference on the bill. And now there's an about-face, and I have a theory as to why the about-face, but I'll let others draw their own conclusions. I will also note that in all those years, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, and 2008, despite the fact that it passed the full Senate, went through all the leaps and all the steps in the Senate and passed the entire body of the Senate, there was never a fiscal note. Because the Attorney General's office always maintained that there wasn't a fiscal note, and I think that was for good reason, because the language then as now says that the Attorney General may get involved in these cases. If they have no desire to be in these cases, they can say, we have enough to do. We're already overburdened and understaffed as it is. We just sustained a big budget cut. We just can't review these False Claims Act cases. We're not going to be in that business for now, or maybe even ever. And they can do that, and that's the reason why there has never, ever been a fiscal note for this bill. Now suddenly there is. There's a change in chief office this year. I'll let you draw your own conclusion. That's the reason I suspect they don't want to be here to submit to questions, because I think they know what the truthful answers that they'll have to give are. And I'm really disappointed that we're in this situation. It would be one thing if an office has a principled stand against the bill. I get that. We all have people that we know or trust or respect that are against the things we want to do. But to be for it and try to sandbag it and kill it because you don't like the people involved with it on year two, based on year one, compared to year one, that's just intellectually dishonest, and I think it speaks volumes about the people involved here. So I want to make that absolutely crystal clear. There has never been a fiscal note, and now suddenly we're talking about millions of dollars. Preposterous. But in the next committee, the Finance Committee, I'm sure we'll have a detailed discussion about it, and I relish it. So now let's talk about the hypotheticals that you've heard about, the licensure fraud and the specific anecdotes that are meant to scare you, of course. Your community hospitals are pillars of the community. I know mine are in my communities, and none of us want to see harm done to those institutions, including nursing homes. I certainly don't. But this idea of, and I checked this because this anecdote by Mr. Feinreich was brought up in a previous committee hearing or meeting about licensure. We could not find a single case nationwide ever in any state or federal law where anyone was on the hook under a False Claims Act because they were accidentally unlicensed. It's a great story, makes for a great scare tactic, but it's just not the case. Not going to happen. It hasn't ever happened. You know, the language we put in, the comfort language, which we already talked about, the sort of finder's keeper's language, I think amply and generously covers all of those provisions. All of those provisions, and it only has to do, if you do discover the error, whether it's a licensure lapse or anything else, and you knowingly fail to report it, if it does start in the mailroom, or it does start with a computer programmer, or it does start with an office clerk, or it does start with anyone, and those in the know with responsibility who bind the company find out and then knowingly don't do anything about it, that's actionable under this law. But doing everything that Mr. Feinwatz did, which was the absolute appropriate, ethical, and right thing to do, and he ought to be congratulated for it, and our hospitals ought to as well, that isn't actionable under this law. It never would be, and it never will be. That's a scare tactic. In terms of frivolous lawsuits, members, we hear this article a lot, this argument a lot, and let me just say this, and not just because we have a federal False Claims Act. If a disgruntled employee today, on March 4, 2009, wants to get at an employer and really go and win the lottery with a lawsuit and lie and cheat, they can do that in any number of ways. And we all live with that as part of life. Anyone in the companies or entities that we work for could claim they slip and fell on the front ice and that it wasn't salted. Could be a lie. They could claim that they were groped during their last yearly review by their supervisor, and it could be a lie. The point is, of course, there always exists a potential for frivolous lawsuits. Of course. But that's the regime that we live under now, and we've made the determination that we have laws out there and they're always subject to abuse. And if you're scared away from voting for this, even though it exists on the federal level, because someone somewhere could misuse it, well, we're living under a host of laws where that's already the case. People can lie. And it's unfortunate that they do, but I don't think this will make it any more or less likely. One other thing I would just say, Mr. Chair and members, you know, I went to four of these town hall meetings in Winona, Mr. Chair, in your backyard, in Albert Lea, in Woodbury, and in Plymouth. And not surprisingly, the two big messages we got were, don't raise my taxes and don't cut my spending. Those were two of the big messages that we got. And that's rational. I don't mean to be flip about it. That's rational to hear. But the one thing we heard from both of those camps, the things that they could agree on, whether they said don't cut my taxes or don't cut my spending, they said, you guys got to think outside of the box. You have to be inventive. You have to do things differently. You have to reform. And remember, this is neither a tax nor a spending cut. This is a way to do that. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we get a 10% bump and bonus even if the law is never used. If we pass this language, we get a bonus year in and year out to the tune probably of millions of dollars per year for doing nothing by merely passing this act. So I understand the concern of some of these stakeholders, the hospitals and others, and they are very valuable members of all of our communities. But please don't be taken in by scare tactics about hypotheticals that will never, ever come to pass.
Representative Simon, you referenced the hearings. Also in Winona, you heard from Winona Health, which is not part of Mayo, not part of Gunderson, not part of the University of Minnesota, that under the governor's budget, approximately 115 employees, that under the governor's budget, approximately 115 employees would have to be laid off, and in effect, you would close the hospital and the clinic. I am also very sensitive to what happens in healthcare, and particularly sensitive to an independent healthcare organization that has been around for 100 years. Raven Merle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, Representative Simon actually raised a number of the points, so I will keep this short. A number of the points I would make. I would note, in my experience, and I'm very disturbed by the same letter the representative was disturbed by, but I'm going to keep it short for saying I respect Representative Simon. I think it's fair to directly or indirectly impugn Representative Simon's motives. I found him to be an honorable representative, and I believe that I signed on to this bill, even though I used to be a trial lawyer, a defense trial lawyer, because I believe this bill is the right way to go. In the testimony, we heard that the person in the hospital did not realize the significance. That was the quote. That's not fraud, because the word knowingly shows up 8 times. Did not realize does not equal fraud. The cost of defense for a frivolous lawsuit, page 7, lines 13 to 15. Someone who brings a clearly frivolous lawsuit will bear the cost of defense. That was not mentioned in the testimony. The Attorney General may bring an action. It's not required. We have to remember that. That was different than the testimony we heard. And finally, members, I don't think there's a fiscal note. Until this legislature sees a fiscal note, and this bill, Mr. Chair, is going to finance.
Yes, it is.
The fiscal note should be discussed at finance, if one even exists, but as of Wednesday, March 4th, there is no fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Merle, I want to ask again, is there an individual from the Attorney General's office here today that wishes to testify on this bill under direct reference to the fiscal note? This is a request of the chair after a meeting with the Attorney General. There is no one here. That is disappointing. Representative Emmer.
No, I think Representative Morrow and Representative Simon have adequately covered my concerns, and I concur entirely.
Right, Representative Tom.
Chairman, I know that you're really very strong on making sure that committees deal with the proper jurisdiction that's before them. As we've said several times, this bill is going to finance, and the issue of the fiscal note should be up. I'm sure finance will not take the bill up until there is a fiscal note. On the just the mathematics of the numbers of attorneys on the bill, there are 7 of the 35 authors are attorneys. That's 20%, and that compares to the 17 out of 134 in the House, which is 15%. So it's only slightly above for a bill that's going to a lot of has a lot of legal words in it. That's not too high a level. So those are just my comments.
But those legal words we'll deal with at another time. Representative Gutwalt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I'm not all that concerned with impugning people's motives or anything, and I understand this conversation is probably necessary. It doesn't go to my concerns, and I'm really not looking for reasons to vote against this bill. I'm looking for reasons to vote for it. I think I want to commend Representative Simon for bringing it forward. In fact, I think we're all against fraud. I want to go back to some of the testimony we had, and it goes to my concern, and perhaps Representative Simon can help answer it. If, in fact, as our friend from Texas testified, that only 10% or less than 10% actually are successfully prosecuted, then obviously, if, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out there's somewhere around 90% that don't. And what is the cost for involvement in prosecuting those? And are those new actions that came up as a result of them passing the state version of this that aren't happening under the federal version? I mean, if there's some way to assure that this isn't suddenly opening up the floodgates and creating additional expense, where only a small percentage of these ever get successfully prosecuted, I'm much closer to being supportive of this bill.
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Powell can elaborate. He would know sort of chapter and verse better than I, at least the Texas experience. But let me tell you my general feeling.
With Mr. Feinwachsen, I think it might be for the time being. I don't see any more questions to you. So thank you very much, and welcome again, and please identify yourself and respond to the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pat O'Connell again. Mr. Representative, I think you and I miscommunicated a little bit. It might be my southern accent. Yes, how many have gotten to completion? And what I was saying was probably only 10% have even gotten to completion yet because we weren't prosecuting them, because we didn't have the staff to do them. As Representative Simon said, we could decline them if we wanted to. I just chose, while I was the chief of division, not to decline them
and extend the cases as long as I felt like I could, because I didn't want to walk away from a case that it turned out was correct and was fraudulent. So I'll just tell you again, the examples that you were given, I had those kind of cases come to me in Texas. And the answer is, I got to prove up on behalf of the state that someone knowingly and intentionally did something bad. And unless I can find the documentation or the testimony that there was a cover-up, that they were doing it purposely, you know, I had the example you had about someone not being licensed. You know, if everybody wasn't licensed, then you'd have a case. Or if a great majority of people were licensed because somebody never checked their license, you might have a case. So this idea that there's going to be this raft of frivolous lawsuits, at least in my experience in Texas, it did not happen. I will tell you that of the cases that we went forward on, there's not a single one we didn't collect on. Finally, any of those were frivolous.
All right, members, we're getting close to the end of our time here. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, pardon my naivete, but on page 7, line 14, just a quick question. Is the whistleblower automatically considered a party who participated in the action as referenced on this line?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Biskin, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, this would be our state-level extension of the Federal False Claims Act. I'm just curious, is this just basically conformity? You said, you know, many times, much like many other states, we adopted some provisions from Texas, it sounds like. Do we basically line up with this bill?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sanders, good question. Originally, when the health plans, as you now know, are neutral, came to us, they had 13 changes, as I think I may have mentioned, and all those 13 were designed to conform with the federal law. They said, look, if you just make it like the federal law in these 13 places, and we've now, by my count, accepted 11 of those, and I just can't remember what the other two are. I can tell you this is very, very close to the federal law. I honestly just can't remember, and maybe someone can, what the couple slight differences are here. So it's very close to exact similarity with the federal law.
All right. Representative, anyone else wish to testify? I have no one else on my list. All right. Representative Simon, to your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for the discussion. And Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for allowing all this time. I know there's a crush of bills that go to this committee, and I know even though we had another one removed at the last minute, it's very generous of you and generous of the committee to hear this the whole time. I understand there's a lot of time pressure on all of you and on you in particular, Mr. Chair, so thank you. I just want to wrap up by saying, members, you know, this is a real chance that we have here to do something that 22 states have done and the federal government has done on a bipartisan basis, and that's to get at those who knowingly, and that's the key word, knowingly defraud the state government. It's a very high hurdle. It's a very high bar, as you've heard from Mr. O'Connell and others. This is not designed to, and nor would I ever carry a bill that would go after institutions of the kind, Mr. Chair, that are in your district or in any of your districts. That's not the aim here. I have to presume that all of them are doing their absolute level best, but we're not just talking about 2009. The day may come in 2019 or 2029 when the great folks that we have running these institutions there are no longer there, and God forbid, there are others who take a dimmer view of some of the excellent policies they put in place. This is a law that we're legislating not just for now, but for the future, and I think that we owe it to ourselves and to our taxpayers to make sure, in doing so, that we can recoup some of these funds. It's their money. It's not ours as legislators. It's not even the government. It's their money. And when someone knowingly defrauds, I think it's reasonable to expect that we can recoup some of that money back. And here again, just passing this law with the four government criteria gets us an automatic bonus. Automatic bonus for doing nothing. If this law sits on the shelf forever, we get that bonus. And I think after working very hard and very long with a lot of the stakeholders, and I'm not done yet, I'm happy to keep meeting with them, and if they have language they want me to entertain, or Senator Leff, I'm happy to do that. And I want them to know here my door is always open. You can call me on my cell phone. You can call me at home. I'll meet with you and I'll work with you. But I think so far we've got a pretty good product here, and I think it does a reasonable thing, and I respectfully ask for your support to go on to the next committee.
Representative Simon, then your motion is?
My motion is, Mr. Chair, renew my motion that House File 8 be recommended to pass and be
as amended
and be re-referred to the Finance Committee with a recommendation that it go to the State Government Finance Division.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Poppy.
I move the minutes of Tuesday, March 3rd.
Representative Poppy moves the minutes of March 3rd. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.